The campaign for governor is in full swing, and this year, three candidates are vying for Alaska's top elected position. They face difficult questions about the state's future, such as what does Alaska need to ensure a strong economy and a healthy, productive workforce? How does the state pursue resource development that is safe, sustainable, and considers all users? How can concerns over crime be handled in an effective manner? Republican candidate Mike Dunleavy will give us his vision for the state's future today on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Today and this week and for the following 2 weeks, we'll hear from all of the candidates running for governor. Today, it's former Wasilla State Senator Mike Dunleavy's chance to discuss his ideas for leading the state. You can join our conversation with your questions for Mr. Dunleavy. You can call us at 1-800-478-8255. That number is 1-800-478-8255 statewide. If you are in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Mr. Dunleavy, welcome.
It's good to be here.
Thanks so much for joining me. I'd like to start by having you give us some of your background for Alaskans who don't know you well. You were born and raised in Pennsylvania, but you've been in Alaska for 35 years or so. Is that correct?
Yeah, I first came up in 1983 from Pennsylvania right out of college. And
Yeah. And so was it work or adventure that lured you here initially?
It was both. I always dreamed of coming to Alaska. I always liked the outdoors. And when I was nearing the end of my college career in Pennsylvania, I had always wanted to come up to the state. And there were some economic opportunities, again, combined with just wanting to be here, that led me to the state. And I came up in spring of 83 and landed in Southeast Alaska as my first stop.
Well, tell us about your life and work in rural Alaska. As I understand it, you spent a lot of time there. I know that you have a background in education. Was your work in rural Alaska all in education?
Well, when I went to Southeast Alaska on Prince of Wales Island, initially that was at a logging camp. That's where I got my feet wet in the state of Alaska. And I then eventually migrated out to Northwest Alaska on the Seward Peninsula, a small village called Koyuk. Spent roughly 6 years in Koyuk, and then went to the University of Alaska Fairbanks for a year to get my master's, complete my master's degree in education administration. And then went up to Kotzebue and spent 13 years in Kotzebue. My wife is from Norvik, which is a village on the Kobuk River not far from Kotzebue. And we had relatives there, and so we settled in Kotz, and this is where we had our children. And I was a teacher, principal, superintendent, and we made our home there.
Well, I want to talk more about your career in education and how that's informed a lot of how you see education today. But first, I want to remind listeners that this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're starting what will be 3 weeks of programs having discussions with the candidates for governor. Today we have Republican Mike Dunleavy on the program, and you can join our conversation if you'd like to, 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. 1-800-478-8255 in Anchorage. It's 550-8422. You can email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. So you have said in statements that you've devoted your life to public service in your earlier career. That service was in education. What prompted your shift to pursuing elected office? Was there one thing that motivated you to run for office, or what sparked that? That's a very different type of public service.
Sure. So as a teacher, you realize that a lot of decisions are being made, quote, above you. A lot of decisions are being made outside of your realm, your influence, that impact the work that you do. And so that was one of the reasons why I decided to become a assistant principal than principal. And you realize that that's at that level, that there's still other levels that impact what you do. And so it's been a continual journey to try and impact or affect policy, specifically how it impacts the interaction between kids and teachers. That's where the rubber meets the road right there. And so just wanted to continually help people, serve the public, improve the educational outcomes for kids, improve the situation for teachers in the classroom, led me to, as I said, go through these various stages of being a principal and then a superintendent. And then you realize that policymakers in Juneau also have a huge impact on what happens, whether it be funding, laws, regulations, you name it. Everyone seems to have their finger in education, but also you realize that it's these policymakers that determine what the environment in the entire state is going to be like, whether it's public safety, whether it's economic opportunities. It just, for me, was a natural extension from what I was doing in helping kids, helping teachers, and then helping constituents in my district.
So talk a little bit about that relationship between kids and teachers. What do you think, as a governor, say, you could do to help that relationship?
I think over the years, that particular relationship has become heavily regulated to the point where I think it's detrimental for that relationship, to be honest with you. And what I'm looking forward to, and I'm having discussions now with teachers, is what is really impacting their ability to help kids have better outcomes, educational outcomes. For example, in March, the NAEP scores, which are national tests that are given to fourth and eighth graders nationally, demonstrated that Alaska is doing poorly. We're almost dead last in reading outcomes, let's say, for fourth graders. To me, this is a systems issue. It's not that the individual students are not bright enough to learn how to read or that the teachers aren't good enough to teach reading, but it's a systems issue. And what you find out is that schools and especially classrooms, teachers are being burdened with so much paperwork, so much regulation, that the time to be able to focus on reading, let's say, has been shortened, or the actual curriculum or actual methodology is changes so often that teachers themselves aren't able to form that relationship with students and be able to work with them and get to know them individually to the point where they can bring those students along based upon what the teacher believes is the best way to teach reading. And so we're talking to teachers now, as I mentioned, we're looking for feedback as to how we can make sure that our third grade students, and this is what it shows in terms of research, that if students are reading on grade level by the time they exit third grade, their chances of succeeding in school is much greater than those if the students are not on grade level by third grade and have to have remediation or special work done to try and improve their reading throughout their career. So third grade is a benchmark for reading, and so we're working with teachers now to try and come up with some ideas that will get us on track to have all students reading by the time they're in third grade. States like Florida went through this situation years ago, where they had poor reading outcomes, and they worked with their teachers and they implemented programs. And today, reading outcomes for students in Florida are much better than they were years ago. So that's what we're hoping to achieve through this process.
Do you think that a lot of it has to do with the size of the class that the teachers have? Do they need more assistance, more teaching assistance in the classroom? Or does it, I mean, certainly a lot of it starts much earlier than that with parents reading to their kids and other things. So what do you see as some of those burdens? You mentioned paperwork that the teachers have to deal with, but what are some of the other areas that are holding them back with progress with students?
Sure. The reason to go into teaching really hasn't changed much over the last 50, 80 years, and that's because you want to help kids. You want to help kids with their future. But what's changed oftentimes is societal expectations. So a lot of teachers are going to the classroom wanting to teach kids how to read, but they are being those classrooms are being impacted by issues beyond the teacher's control. Things coming in from potentially families or society or the neighborhood that the kid lives in, whether there be issues involving trauma or drugs. These are things that are impacting the classroom that get in the way of that whole the whole process of actually learning, because if the child's not ready to learn or if there are things impacting that child's life, it makes it difficult to teach the child how to read or to be able to perform well in other subject areas such as math. So the feedback that we're getting from some folks in the educational world, especially teachers in the classroom, is society is changing. How do we address some of these needs so that the teacher isn't the nurse, the social worker, the therapist, et cetera? How do we deal with the issues where a particular child or two in a classroom that may be so disruptive that learning can't take place for the rest of the kids? And so we're having these discussions to come up with potentially some policy or at least some discussion points for society at large. How do we change what we do in the classroom, again, so that the teacher is freed to do what they were trained to do, and that is teach, for example, the content areas. And classrooms may look very different. Schools may look very different as we go into the future to try and address some of these issues that are changing in society.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's certainly a lot more we could discuss about education, and we'll probably get to some more of those questions. But I want to remind our listeners, this is Talk of Alaska, and we have Republican Mike Dunleavy, the candidate for governor, on with us today. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK statewide. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's move on to some other issues that the governor's office has to deal with. What would be your plan if you're elected for keeping the cost of state government down that also maintains appropriate levels of service for law enforcement, education, as we've been discussing, and health care? It's this juggling act of keeping the budget trim, but also making sure that these areas are covered.
Right. So we need to do a couple of things. We need to become more efficient in what we do. We need to take a look and audit some of our programs, if not all of our programs, all of our divisions, all of our departments, to see if we are efficient, to see if there are redundancies or duplications of services. What are some things we can do better? And, you know, when oil was at $26 a barrel and we had a $3 billion plus gap, we were, a number of us were looking at some serious reductions. But today, as we talk about the budget, we're at about $75, $76 a barrel oil. The permanent fund has done really well. It's gone from approximately $8 to $10 billion just 2 years ago to $19 billion in the earnings reserve. And so we have right now the revenues to help pay for government going forward, but we need to continue to develop our resources to increase our revenue stream. We can't just take money from one individual out of their pocket and give it to another in the form of a tax. We have tremendous resources in this state, and it's going to be a cornerstone of my administration that we develop those resources, that we produce more oil, that we create more mining plays for folks to be employed, that we work with the federal government to try and get a timber industry back in the state of Alaska, both in the Tongass and the Chugach National Forest. If we do this, we could put people to work. We can get them off welfare. We can get them off Medicaid, which would reduce the cost of government for everyone. It would also produce more revenue to hire more troopers, to hire more prosecuting attorneys, to make our streets and our schools and our playgrounds safer. It would also allow us to put more revenue into classrooms, as we were talking about earlier, to focus on things like reading and mathematics, algebraic outcomes in by ninth grade is another issue that we're looking at for education. So by making government more efficient now, by making sure that we're not spending on unnecessary items now, and by producing more wealth, by putting Alaska's resources to work, I really foresee in the next several years that we can pull ourselves out of this and we can be on a path of a sustainable budget. The thing we can't continue to do, however, is not produce wealth and continue to grow our budgets at 6, 7, 8, 9% a year. Because if we do that, we outstrip our ability to pay for it. Because if we're not producing if we're not exploring, developing, and producing resources and wealth at that rate, you never catch up. And so you always end up in this game where you're every once in a while you're talking about reductions and you're talking about cutting programs. And so when you get good programs going that are having an impact and helping folks, if we don't have the revenue at that point to continue to fund those programs, you end up cutting those programs. So we have to have a continual exploration, development of our resources to create a sustainable revenue stream.
So a lot of the development ideas that you're putting forward, more oil and gas, mining, other things, a lot of that takes time to ramp up. I mean, that wouldn't happen next season. This could take several years to get a lot of these online so that they would be producing revenue. What do you think, is there ever a point that you think a short-term tax of some sort might be appropriate to help make sure that the state stays fiscally solvent until some of those other larger projects could come online.
We just have to be careful with taxes because they change behaviors. For example, if you want somebody to stop smoking, put 100% tax on a packet of cigarettes. You're gonna start to change behavior, and people are gonna stop smoking. If you really want people to stay in the state of Alaska, you have to be careful about taxes because those that can will leave. The lower 48 right now is booming. The unemployment rate is at record lows in many states. They're looking for workers. Many of our workers have already left that were in the oil industry that were laid off a few years ago. So we have to be careful with the concept of taxes because, again, we'll push those people out. And what will the individuals that will be left here will be people that still need to be trained to work and still may need some of our government programs, our welfare programs, until they can get to that point. But who's going to pay for that? That's the issue. So it's my contention that we be very, very careful about taxes. I don't think we need taxes at this point. Again, oil's at $74 a barrel. Production is actually growing. Within 2 years, we're anticipating another additional 100,000 barrels in the pipeline from the new finds that were discovered next to the pipeline over the last several years. And then there are predictions that over the next 3 to 7 years, we'll have another additional 300,000 barrels in the pipeline. The key to the future of Alaska, in my opinion, is being able to control our operating budget. We can't continue to spend at 8% a year or 6% a year. If we can get this operating budget contained to about 2% a year, that'll allow us to keep up with those expenditures through new revenues that we will be able to develop, as mentioned, on the pipeline.
Well, let's go to the phones and hear from some Alaskans about some resource ideas. Terry is in Valdez. Hi, Terry. You have a question about the Pebble Mine?
Yeah, good morning. The Pebble Mine, I see it as one of the worst ways for us to develop our state resources. The Bristol Bay Salmon Run is, we're trying to chop the head off the goose that's laid the golden egg. That's a very risky maneuver, and I think most Alaskans don't realize that we don't get a royalty for minerals. We get a royalty from the fossil fuels, but not from metal. And so we're risking the Bristol Bay Run for a foreign government that wants to come in and put a huge open-pit mine in there. The state constitution states that we should develop our resources for the benefit of all. That's hardly the case there. It's going to cost a lot more jobs than it will ever create. And it was designated a conservation zone during the Hammett administration that nothing should affect the watershed of Bristol Bay. And so I'd like your comments on that. And one other thing, SB 21, how much does that affect our present budget woes? And I'll get off the line and listen to your comments.
So let me address SB 21 first. That was the oil tax revisions that occurred a few years ago. And the purpose of that revision was to try and spur new exploration, development, and production. It did do that. We had new and smaller players come in, such as Hillcorp and ENI and others. Armstrong, Kalis came in to do some exploration. They found a lot of oil, actually found a lot of oil. And that's the oil that we were talking about earlier that we'll be getting into the pipeline over the next several years, which will increase our revenue. So that particular approach, I think it could be argued, actually worked. Going to Pebble, The issue with Pebble, from my perspective, is really the process, the study process. We have permitting and study processes in place in the state of Alaska as part of our Department of Natural Resources and the other departments that affect these type of mining plays. I believe we need to allow those studies to happen to see what the outcomes are. The studies may actually show that, in fact, Pebble is not a mine that we should have, that it would, in fact, disturb the headwaters of the fisheries there in Bristol Bay. But we'll never know that unless we go through the study process. And so my only concern is that if we politicize the study process just for this particular mine or this particular play, what's to prevent us from politicizing other projects in the state of Alaska to the detriment of the state of Alaska and our potential revenue and employment prospects?
All right, let's stay with the phones, and we're going to go to Joe, who is in Point Baker, I guess, on a boat. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, hi. Nice to be with you this morning.
Comments. You're breaking up there, Joe, hoping that we can hear you. I understand you had a comment about the timber industry or a question?
It's fairly unfeasible to try to bring back the timber industry to put money in the state's coffers. Right now, the timber industry has, the state-run timber industry has timber sales that only to pay the wages of the foresters that work for the state industry. No money actually returns to the state coffers. There's none left. The timber industry also is kind of being force-fed by round log export. That's all we have. We're exporting jobs, but we're not creating very many jobs. And it's certainly going to be no panacea for economic regrowth of the state. To hear a candidate for governor kind of mouth this fantasy. But on the other side, the environmental side of the question, trees, the Tongass is considered the fifth largest carbon sink in the world for absorption of carbon from the atmosphere. And I think it's important to look towards the future and the climate, warming climate, and try to protect and reserve these forests if they do nothing else and hold back carbon and produce oxygen. I think they'd be serving us more than well, but they also create huntable populations of wildlife, fish, and subsistence food. So I just wanted to clarify that point for Mr. Dunleavy and also for the present governor, Governor Walker, who I've written on this issue and received no response.
Okay, so, Joe.
Good luck with your campaign, sir.
Let's let Mr. Dunleavy respond to his thoughts about what should happen. You know, at one point in time, there was an enormous timber logging industry in Southeast, especially. Not so much anymore. What do you think should happen in the future?
I appreciate the question. I really do. And so again, I came up. I worked in a logging camp, and there were logging camps up and down Southeast Alaska, and they had created jobs for people. And when people were working, these people did not need to be on welfare programs or government assistance. Looking at the future, there's going to be more and more demand for timber worldwide. And so I think Alaska, with 1/7 of the entire country's timber reserves, and Alaska does have 1/7 of the reserves for the entire country, I think there's some real opportunity. Now, in terms of money going into the coffers of the state, such as through a royalty or revenue, that's not what we're really looking at in some of these micro economies, for example, for Southeast Alaska. The timber, again, will produce jobs. There is going to be a demand for timber. And I want to just touch upon something the caller said. You really take carbon out of the air when you take down a tree and you sequester that tree into a building or into furniture. If you let the tree just rot and fall over, the carbon's released back into the atmosphere. So you really don't take more out. For example, in the interior Alaska, we have trees that are rotting and falling over. We have trees that are burning. In Southeast Alaska, you have trees that are rotting and falling over as well. This is going to release carbon. If you really want to sequester carbon, and then there are some environmentalists that are starting to catch on to this because of all the wildfires that have occurred down south. Not only is there a danger to people and property, but if you have an unhealthy forest, you're releasing carbon. If you have a healthy forest and you're sequestering trees into homes, buildings, and furniture, you're taking that carbon out of the air. And you're allowing new trees to grow, and you have a healthier and healthier forest. So, I think a robust timber industry in the state of Alaska, I think, is good across the board, not just for jobs and getting people off of government assistance, but also for the environment.
All right, let's stay with this resource idea for a little bit. We're going to go to Don in Juneau, who wants to talk about roads and resources. Hi, Don.
Good morning. How are you? Good morning, Senator.
Good morning.
Hey, I just want to say that you have hit the nail on the head when it comes to how we are going to pull ourselves out of this longest recession that our state's ever been in. You can't tax your way out of a recession. The way you do it is by developing our natural resource base, which is what makes Alaska as rich as it is. And being a fourth generation Ketchikanite, my great-grandfather rolled in there at the turn of the century. To hear somebody say that we can rejuvenate the timber industry and do it properly,
Hello?
The gentleman that called from the boat is the exact reason we need you to be governor of this state right now. We have the highest unemployment rate in the country. And the way we're going to get out of this is by creating jobs. And we're going to create jobs with roads to resources and electric lines to mine. And I wish you the best of luck, Senator. And I can't wait to call you governor.
Thank you. Thanks, Don.
All right. I wanted to ask just before we go back to the phones and take some email questions, to talk a little more about where you think, you know, you talked a bit about percentage growth for the operating budget for the state. Do you have a number in mind for what you think an adequate state budget should be? And where would you seek to do more cutting as governor?
So right now, it's really efficiencies. And let me give you an example. So there's roughly 24,000 state employee positions. Last year, 22,000 of those positions were filled, but 24,000 were funded. So 2,000 positions were funded but not filled. This represents almost $200 million. We're not quite sure where that money went. They call it the vacancy factor. Some of that money was probably used for overtime in some of the departments and divisions. Some of it was probably used for travel, equipment, who knows. But the point is that money was supposed to be earmarked for positions, but those 2,000 positions were not filled. So there's $200 million right there that could be discussed as to how we want to use that going forward. Do we want to use that money and hire more troopers? Do we want to use that money and hire more prosecuting attorneys? Do we want to use that money and keep the courts open on Friday to improve our public safety situation? I also ran a bill a few years ago in which the bill would consolidate the 54 school districts' health insurance plans. And the reason we did that is we want to see if there would be a cost savings to the state of Alaska. What we found, and a study actually backed this up, that there could be upwards of $100 million in cost savings if that were to occur. And so we may have that discussion in the future to see if school districts want to voluntarily be part of a larger pool to drive down costs. If so, the potential is $100 million there. So we're looking at $300 million without cuts at this point. So far, we've just talked about efficiencies. And we're getting information from providers, healthcare providers, and those involved in Medicaid and Medicaid expansion, that if those programs are run more efficiently, if more of our programs are moved off of the state funding onto the federal funding that the state is receiving, we could save upwards of $150 million there per year. So between those three moves with no cuts at all, you're looking at potentially $400 million plus. $200 million in the vacancy factor issue, $100 million in the health insurance, and the $150 million in efficiencies, just in those three areas. It's several hundred million dollars. That could get our budget down to about $4.1 billion without cuts. If we get our budget down to about $4.1 billion, somewhere in that neighborhood, and then let it grow, the operating aspect of the budget, the operating side of the budget, at about 2% a year, we can maintain, we can keep up with some inflationary costs at 2% a year, but it also gives us some breathing room to get these other resources online, to get this other oil in the pipeline and increase our revenue stream. So the bottom line is we can no longer be all things to all people, and that's what Alaska tried to be. It was fantastic for 40 years, but we spent a lot of money. We don't have a lot to show for it. We haven't built any big infrastructure projects or roads to resources that would continually help us develop, explore, develop, and produce resources to help pay for Alaska. Keep in mind one thing, which is I think people forget. There was a big debate about whether Alaska should become a state because the concern was it could never really take care of itself because of the small population. As a result, through the Statehood Act and our Constitution, our resources are collectivized under the state government. You cannot drill under your property and lay claim to the oil or the gas that's under your property. And the reason for that, the feds, and then we agreed to do it as a state to collectivize our resources, was to be able to develop those resources to produce revenue for the state of Alaska. Because the idea, again, was not to tax ourselves, but to be able to use those resources to provide that revenue. And that's what we should get back to.
All right. My guest today on Talk of Alaska is Republican candidate for Governor Mike Dunleavy. We will take more calls and more questions after this short break as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and today we have the Republican candidate for governor, Mike Dunleavy, former state senator, here in the studio with us, taking questions, and you can bring your questions forward if you'd like to join us. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. 1-800-478-TALK is the number. If you're in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. We had a question about fisheries. This is kind of a lengthy question, but it is from Lainey Welsh with Alaska's Fish Radio. And she says that most of Alaska's fishing industry is of the opinion that Mr. Dunleavy has little regard for the state's oldest industry. He has not visited nor responded to requests for interviews by coastal community residents. One of his biggest backers is a wealthy sport fishing advocate. What can Mr. Dunleavy say to reassure members of one of Alaska's largest industries that he will work on their behalf to sustain the seafood industry, and what are his ideas for enhancing the industry? This is an email question. Mr. Dunleavy, what your response?
So thank you, Lainey. I want to grow all industries, including commercial fisheries. When I was in the Senate, I opposed efforts to genetically modify salmon, and I demanded proper labeling. That was one of the things I did for the industry. I also opposed creating marine sanctuaries in Alaska without an adequate public process. I also supported changes to the Commercial Fishing and Agriculture Bank that helped commercial fisheries. I support legislation to create a better crew member licensing program as well. I supported efforts to preserve product development tax credits for salmon and herring products. And I also supported qualified candidates to the Board of Fisheries, ASMI Board, ASME Board, and CFEC and Fishermen's Fund as well. So the idea, and I've heard this often, the idea that I'm anti-commercial fishing, there's really no basis for that. When I was representing my constituency in the upper Mad Valley, rural Mad Valley, we had the Upper Susitna River that we were concerned about. And we had a crash in the fisheries there. The fish were just not returning to that that watershed. And so my constituents, 90-some percent, who were not commercial fishermen, but sports fishermen or personal use fisheries, they wanted to get more fish in the river. And so I worked at doing that. My opinion was that getting more fish in the river was going to benefit everyone, not just personal use fisheries, sports fisheries, but also commercial fisheries. And so I think through the work that I did and I've done in the Senate, I think I've demonstrated that I'm not anti-commercial fisheries, but actually want to support the industry. And I understand that folks believe that some of the individuals supporting me are anti-commercial fishery. I'm not. I'd be more than happy to sit down with folks. I do sit down with folks that are in the commercial fishery world, and I have many commercial fishermen actually helping with our campaign.
Her follow-up question is asking if you would commit to participate in the Kodiak fisheries debate set for October 22nd. She says every leading governor candidate since 1991 has been there.
I believe that our team is in contact with those folks and actually setting something up so that we have that we'll be there, that we're planning on being there.
All right. Thank you for that. Let's talk a little bit about the permanent fund dividend. You've said that you want to restore it. Do you think it should be used for both state government spending in the future and dividends? And what should that look like in order to ensure that the fund is protected in the future?
Yeah, that was the intent of the fund was to be used for both PFD and government. And so I've never deviated from that position. So right now we have about $19 billion in the earnings reserve of the fund. That's the fund that can be used to pay out a dividend, or to also be used for government. And my contention has always been, just let the fund alone. Let the permanent fund and the dividend program alone, let it operate like it has for the past several decades. It worked well. There was never a problem with it. What happened was, when we decided to keep spending money in the face of a dramatic drop in oil prices and revenue, we decided to go into the fund, but we didn't go in to use the other half of the fund that was reserved for government use. We went and we went after the permanent fund dividend. This caused a problem, and it should have caused a problem, because there was no need to do that. We took approximately $2 billion out of the economy over the last several years by cutting the PFD. We took money out of an economy that was in recession. This exacerbated the situation where people were being laid off. And then we doubled down on that by removing this money from the economy. As a result, we had a lot of small businesses that have gone bankrupt. It added more woe to the recession than helped. In addition, that money that was taken out of the PFD was actually just kept in the earnings reserve. It was never used for government. And a lot of people are surprised when they hear that. They thought that they were giving up part of their PFD to help pay for government. Never did go to government up until this past year. This past year, with SB 26, approximately $2.7 billion can be taken out of the fund to be used for both government and the PFD. And so it's always been my contention, leave the permanent fund alone, leave the PFD alone, work at containing the size of the budget, making sure that the budget doesn't grow exponentially every year. If you do that, we can make this work. And I'll also add, if we don't contain the size of the budget, no fiscal plan is going to work and will fail within a few short years. And the fiscal plan, for example, that the governor is putting forth, in which we use part of the earnings of the permanent fund and we reduce the size of the PFD, even that fiscal plan is going to fail if we keep approving budgets of 6, 7, 8% a year. We just can't keep up with it. That's why I'm saying we have to put our resources to work and develop larger and more diversified revenue streams.
Do you think that there may be a need in the future, if populations in the state grow and other factors like oil prices change, maybe go down and stay down, do you think there might be a need to consider a cap on the amount of the dividend?
I think when it comes to the permanent fund and the dividend, everything should be discussed, but the people should be involved in that discussion. And I think that's what really upset the Alaskans the most. When I go around the state and I talk with folks, and I'm talking with wealthy folks as well that don't need the PFD, and they'll tell you that. They say to me, Mike, the way that was handled was just wrong. The people had an expectation for decades. This worked well for decades. We thought we were part of the process. And when this happened, when the governor vetoed the portion of the PFD without any discussion, any advisory vote, anything involving input from the people, that's what got people upset. Because you have to remember, nobody really complained when the permanent fund dividend was $700 one year or $900 one year or $600 one year. People accepted that formula. People accepted that it was driven by the market. The moment politicians put their fingers in that process, that's when people got upset. And that's the issue. People should be involved in the discussions involving the permanent fund and the PFD, at least in an advisory vote.
All right, let's go back to the phones for a moment. Mark is in Bethel and has a question about the marijuana industry in the state. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, good morning. Sure, thanks. Economic development, Alaska's natural resources, I'm wondering, as I think a lot of other people are, you're a social conservative. What are your thoughts, your feelings, and maybe your intentions as governor? Concerning Alaska's legal marijuana industry?
I'm going to follow the law, Mark, and as long as the laws are in place regarding marijuana, I'll implement the laws and I'll follow the laws.
All right.
Okay. Well, thanks very much.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mark. So if you prevail in November and are elected governor, what would your first three priorities be?
Public safety has got to be job number one. It's out of control. We are an unsafe state by any measure, the worst in the country at this point. 2 years ago, we had about 604 violent incidences per 100,000 people in the state of Alaska. We're now up to 804, according to federal statistics. You go to a park now, and you have to look around for needles before you let your kids play on the toys at the park. I pulled up to a gas station the other day, went to pump gas, looked down, there were a pile of needles at my feet that somebody dumped out of their car. We can talk about this for some time, but the bottom line is we are an unsafe state. The criminals have gotten the upper hand. So the first thing we have to do is make sure that we have the adequate number of troopers present in our communities. We have to make sure that we have the right number of prosecuting attorneys that can move the cases through rapidly. We have to make sure the courts are open on Fridays. We have to make sure that we have the funding available for those that want to get off of drugs, that are addicted to drugs. And we have to make sure that we send a message to all criminals, especially those that are dealing death in terms of drugs such as heroin or fentanyl, that they're going to pay a stiff penalty under my administration, that this is no longer going to be business as usual, that they're going to have to look for another state to go to because Alaska is going to be closed to criminals.
And your second and third priorities?
It's literally not one, two, and three. It's like one, one, one. It's you can't put one above the other. So we also need to make sure that our fiscal house is in order. And again, we do that by using the efficiencies I mentioned earlier in the program, and capping the size of our operating growth at about 2% a year in terms of our budget. We're also going to make sure that the PFD gets back into the hands of the people, as was calculated over the past several decades. And we've got to make sure that our educational outcomes are better than they are today. We have to make sure that kids are reading by the time they leave third grade. We have to make sure that students are proficient in algebra by the time they leave ninth grade. And we have to really revisit the concept of career ed back into our schools, because not all students are going to be going to college. And we have to make the schools safer to make sure that there are... the kids can be sent to school in the morning by their parents, and their parents can be rest assured that the kids will remain safe in those schools and not have to worry about any incidences occurring at those schools, violent incidences occurring at those schools. And last thing we need to do is make sure that we're managing our natural resources the right way, whether it's fish, whether it's oil, gold. All of our natural resources need to be managed so we can grow those industries, produce jobs, and produce revenue.
Let's talk a little more about what you identified as your top priority, which is public safety in the state. I think that resonates with a lot of Alaskans. How do you see that intersecting with tribes? In rural Alaska, there is a chronic shortage of law enforcement and has been for a very long time. The state's attorney general released an opinion regarding tribes and their inherent sovereignty as tribal nations. Do you think that there should be some cooperation as far as tribal governments working with the state, bringing in federal dollars to enhance law enforcement through that relationship that tribes have with the federal side to help enhance law enforcement in rural Alaska? And if so, what would that look like?
I think we should be cooperating with all stakeholders in the state of Alaska, all entities in the state of Alaska. As I mentioned earlier, I spent 19 years in rural Alaska in small communities. My wife is from a small community in rural Alaska. She's Native Alaskan. Our kids were born out there. I was a teacher there. I was a principal, superintendent. And so I believe that all stakeholders in the state of Alaska should be involved in affecting a more positive outcome in terms of public safety. And so I'd be more than happy and willing to sit down with all entities, including tribes, to see how we can get to this point where we can make our community safer.
We have a question about the president and whether or not you voted for Donald Trump, and do you approve of his performance?
That's a great question. When it comes to the president's view on jobs, creating wealth, developing our natural resources, I agree with what he's doing. I'm glad that we were able to get ANWR open, and I'm looking forward to working with the president where it benefits the state of Alaska as governor. I have every intention of sitting down with the president and seeing how we can continue to explore and produce, develop our resources in the state of Alaska. So from that perspective, I think the president's doing a very good job.
And did you say you did vote for him?
The vote was a private vote, but I do support the president.
Do you consider yourself more of a Donald Trump or a John McCain-style Republican?
I consider myself more of a Mike Dunleavy Republican.
All right, fair enough. All right, let's go back to the phones for a moment and take another question about the permanent fund. Diane is in Anchorage. Hi, Diane.
Hi. Given your statement that you want to put a cap on state spending, it doesn't seem that will work unless you also can control the number of people who live here. And my question to you is, how does a bigger dividend check make it safer for me to drive the Seward Highway, given the troopers have already been reduced dramatically and stations closed, or Child Protective Services be funded because we have a big need there, or the university system?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know how a bigger dividend check protects you from those things. A bigger dividend check or dividend allows folks to spend that money on their own personal needs, whether it's car repair, medical needs, fuel, oil, et cetera. That's a decision that they make. I mentioned earlier in the program that I believe that through efficiencies, we can realize several hundred million dollars that we can shift into public safety and troopers, that we can shift into making sure that our roads are safer and we have better outcomes in our schools. Right now, we just have no controls on our budget in terms of our operating budget. It's from one year to the next, it just continually increases over time without any controls. And so again, 7-8% increase in your budget. This year, for example, with federal money, the budget increased 13%. The point I'm trying to make regarding the budget is that we just can't keep up with that unless we continue to produce our resources. But I believe that through efficiencies, we can beef up our public safety situation, and we can have better outcomes for education and maintain our roads.
All right. Thanks for the question, Diane. We're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue with questions as Talk of Alaska continues with candidate for governor, Republican Mike Dunleavy.
Funding for Talk of Alaska was made possible in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and listeners just like you. Thank you.
And by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at Matson.com.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Republican candidate for governor Mike Dunleavy is our guest this hour, and we're taking calls by callers, questions, and email questions. Here is a question by email about increased job opportunities, and the question is, what is your philosophy on bringing manufacturing business opportunities to the state? That's always been a challenge.
We certainly want to diversify our economy, and we do have challenges. One of the things that we have to have a discussion on is what type of fuel source we're going to use to try and drive down the cost, for example, of energy and electricity in particular. If we can get our electrical costs somewhere down in the neighborhood of 15 cents a kilowatt hour, especially in the rail belt, we have an opportunity, we have a chance of bringing manufacturing into the state of Alaska. For example, Iceland, because of its hydro and its geothermal resources, they're able to have electricity at about 4 cents a kilowatt hour. As a result, they have four smeltering plants on their island that smelter aluminum, because aluminum smeltering is energy intensive. But they're able to do that because of the resources that they have and the resources that they've harnessed. If Alaska can decide whether it's going to be coal, gas, hydro, a combination of, and we seriously sit down and decide what route we're going to go in order to get our electrical costs down, I think you'll see manufacturing come to Alaska. I think you'll see a value-added process has come to Alaska and employ a lot of folks.
All right, let's jump around a little bit in our last 10 minutes here. David is on the line from Kenai and has a question about education vouchers. Hi, David.
Good morning. Senator Murkowski says vouchers don't work in rural Alaska, but Mr. Dunleavy, you've been one of the biggest proponents for vouchers in Alaska with an estimated cost of $100 million. How can we afford these private for-profit schools that have no accountability to the public?
So we The state currently does not involve itself in private for-profit schools. There are private schools in the state of Alaska, but the state does not directly involve itself in those private for-profit schools. What we do have, for example, in our homeschool, public homeschool situation, is we do have allotments, and we've had allotments for many, many years. In some of these private, or excuse me, some of these public homeschools have allotments of upwards of $2,000, $2,500 for each student to be able to go develop an individual learning plan and allow the student to get their education at various different venues and with various different vendors. I don't know how we can determine if, quote, vouchers work in rural Alaska or urban Alaska, because we've never really had that opportunity in the state of Alaska. My goal is to work on public educational outcomes and to try and partner with any and all entities to make sure that kids have the best opportunity, the best learning opportunities, and get the best outcomes possible.
All right, thanks, David. Let's go to Jerry in Seward, who also has an education question. Hi, Jerry. Jerry? Maybe Jerry's gone. All right, well, let's get back to public safety. SB 91 created a new pretrial division that supervises people who are released on parole. The goal was to help communities be safer and hold defendants accountable. Would you repeal SB 91? And if so, would you keep that program in place if you did repeal it?
We're certainly looking at the prospects of repealing 91. And what we would do is move those items that law enforcement, victims' rights commissions, other stakeholders believe are actually good, positive items in 91, move those items into another vehicle, and then fill in the holes where again, these stakeholder groups, along with those in the administration legislature, feel we need to close the gaps. But the items that seem to work right now in 91, and as a result of 54, we would keep those items and ship them over to another vehicle.
I'm going to combine an email question on crime and justice, a question that is stating getting tough on crime may mean increased numbers of people being incarcerated and needing treatment. So the question is asking about your thoughts on restorative justice and mental health treatment for inmates. And that's sort of tied to the question of crime being tied to addiction. How would you help people gain access to treatment options and to support them as they go through treatment?
There's no doubt if we're going to turn the public safety issue around and make this a much more safer state, it has to be a multi-pronged approach. And the issues that you just highlighted have to be part of any public safety, a comprehensive public safety approach. And so we're going to need to shift resources into those areas, as well as taking care of folks that are addicted, making sure that we have the proper number of beds and the treatment facilities and the right programs to help get those folks off of those substances. There are many folks that unfortunately got addicted to opiates and other drugs as a result of injuries at work, surgeries, et cetera. And we need to work with those folks, as well as folks that got addicted through potentially recreational use of the drugs, to get them off. It's got to be multi-pronged. Those folks need to be helped, but also those that are dealing in drugs and don't really have any regard for human life or the potential for somebody being injured or dying as a result of their activities. Those folks need to be held accountable. So it's got to be a multi-pronged approach to make this work.
Commissioner Dean Williams has been making changes within the Department of Corrections to try to mirror some of the work of the Norway prison system by making the corrections system more of a rehabilitation center. Data from across Europe and the United States shows that this approach does reduce recidivism, makes communities safer. What do you think of this, and would you continue to support it?
Again, we'll be looking at anything and everything that works. And I have to repeat that. We'll be looking at anything and everything that works. For those things that don't work and we're wasting our money or we aren't getting the outcomes that we had hoped for, we have to discontinue that process or those programs. But for things that are working and are research-based and actually have outcomes that can be measured and the research has been done on these approaches, I think we should seriously consider them.
And what are your thoughts on punitive consequences for criminal activity? Other than incarceration, wellness courts, electronic monitoring, Do you think that's all part
again? Again, we're going to be looking at everything, and if the research is there to back up a certain approach, and it's something that would benefit our public safety position in Alaska, we're going to be taking a look at it.
Let's talk just for a moment or two about climate change. We had an email question from Chris. What are the implications in your mind of climate change for Alaska, in particular the challenges to our coastal communities, but also for our economy in general?
Well, certainly the any changes in the climate, and we're really talking about if the climate is warming, it's going to have an impact on the entire planet, including Alaska. And we've seen some warming here the last several decades in the state of Alaska. And you know, I'm not going to argue whether the globe is warming or not. It appears to be warming. The question is, what can we do about it as Alaskans? We don't have a smokestack industry in the state of Alaska. We're really not contributing to the CO2 issue or the methane issue as other countries and other locales are, simply because we don't have a manufacturing base in the state of Alaska or an industrial base in the state of Alaska. So we're just going to have to work with others to see how we deal with the impacts on our coastal communities. Places like Shishmaref and Kivalina, they are being impacted. It is being impacted by warmer falls, more storms coming in off the coast, lack of sea ice to protect these communities. And we're going to have to roll up our sleeves, work with a whole bunch of stakeholder groups, both in the state and federally, to see how we're going to be able to deal with making sure we take care of our people.
We only have about a minute left, and this is kind of a big question to ask in 1 minute, but we had an email question about the gas pipeline project and your thoughts about its viability.
I don't have enough information to be able to say it's a yes or a no. And quite frankly, I don't think anyone does. That project right now is cloaked in a lot of confidentiality agreements. So a lot of the discussions are taking place behind closed doors that none of us are privy to unless you've signed those confidentiality agreements. As a result, it's difficult for me to say this is a project that can work or not. It certainly seems to be challenged by economics, by the cost of the project. This is the largest project potentially in North America's history. And I just want to make sure that folks understand that we're going to take a look at this project once we get in there, and we're going to do what's right for Alaska. If this looks like it's a potential that it can actually return a benefit to Alaska without posing a huge risk for current generations and future generations, we'll seriously take a look at the project. But we've got to get in there and look at these confidentiality agreements before we can make an intelligent decision.
Do you think the current dust up over tariffs hurts the prospect for a project such as this?
I don't think it helps when you've the potential of increased cost of upwards of 25%. I don't think it helps. I think you already have a challenged project now, and an increase of 25% just makes it more challenging.
All right, we're out of time. Thanks so much, former State Senator Mike Dunleavy, current Republican candidate for governor. Thanks for joining us. Thank you, Alaskans, for joining us. Next week, we have Democrat Mark Begich joining us, and the week after, the incumbent, Bill Walker, will be on with us on Talk of Alaska. Thanks to Dave Waldron, our engineer, and Wesley Early on phones. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by Strong Hearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
Want a fulfilling volunteer opportunity, educating and protecting your community? As a trained Medicare counselor, you'll help stop fraud and connect people with the benefits they've earned. You can make a powerful difference for Alaska's seniors. Learn more at medicare.alaska.gov or call Alaska's Medicare Information Office at 800-478-6065. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This program is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. This is Alaska Public Media.